Hello, everybody. This is Keith Pannell, and I'm welcoming you back to another Science Studio program. And today we're going to be talking about water, purification of water, provision of water for people to drink and utilize in other manners. But, of course, as usual, we have a special guest to talk about the topic. And today we have a professor from Yale University. His name is Jae Hong Kim, and he's from the Department of Chemical and Environmental Engineering at Yale. And Jae Hong, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Before we get into water and engineering and the environment and all these topics, let's talk a little bit about Jae Hong. How did you get into being in the what we call STEM area, science, technology, engineering, math? What were the driving forces as a young person?
Well, from when I was very young, I think the science has been always an interesting subject to me. When I was in elementary school, the fifth grade, that was the time that the personal computers were becoming quite popular in Korea. And I was one of the first generations who started programming in Korea as a younger age person, and started to work on the languages like BASIC and assembler and stuff. And my motivation was very clear. I wanted to make games.
Of course.
Yeah. So there were a few interesting, and nowadays it's maybe called very primitive games. But I spent a whole chunk of my youth making games. My favorite characters at that time were Superman, E.T., and Gundam. That's a Gundam is a robot, the Japanese robot, okay? And fighting each other and stuff like that. So I spent quite some time.
So they had graphics?
Oh, yeah, I had graphics.
All right, lovely.
You know, you can imagine the, you know, little Apple II computer screen. The Superman is just flying around and hitting, punching E.T., and E.T. becomes a skeleton or something like that.
Was this actually, did you have a club in your school of people like-minded like yourself that were trying to compete with each other for the game and then playing against each other? And
There are not many kids who were doing that at the
right.
time, and I was one of very few. And at least I had one friend who was doing the similar thing, and he's now a computer science professor in back in Korea.
Okay.
So, but through that process, I spent quite some time solving some equations that I was not supposed to solve because
you were in fifth grade.
Yeah, and my first moon landing simulator I made in when I was in junior in middle school. And I had to solve some force balance that we never learned. So I spent entire summer studying physics. And again, the goal was to make the game that impressed my friends.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, and just through the course of that, I just felt very comfortable in mathematics and the physics and stuff.
Tell me about your parents, sort of. How did they react to this little boy doing such very sophisticated activities? Did they play the games with you?
No. They have no idea about the games, but my parents were pleased when I first got the national championship in elementary school. So, and I wrote a little check.
Oh, lovely.
Right. So, yeah, from that time, I think I was always, thinking about becoming sort of science engineer, but
okay.
I was never into the chemistry or anything. But I always found that working on those subjects, more deterministic, you work on program, if everything is right, they spit out something that you expect. I loved that concept.
Right.
And that's pretty much science, that you think about something, you do test.
That's the idea, yes.
That's
I mean, I'm a chemist. And if I was to say that every idea that we start at the beginning turns out in the appropriate manner, I would be lying very much.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of difference between what you just went through and what we do, for example, in experimental science.
Right.
What did you study?
I went to the chemical engineering. I still don't remember exactly why, but back in Korea, you spend whole your high school life just studying for that college entrance examination.
Correct.
And so I dropped computer programming, I was a big basketball player, but then I stopped playing basketball. I gained like 20 pounds when I was studying for college entrance examination. And right after that, it's a whole different new story. In Korean system, it's very interesting in a way that you don't get a lot of exposure to different fields or anything. You just really become a very efficient bookworm.
Right.
And after you accumulate enough scores, then you start to look at the rankings of university and the rankings of the department. And chemical engineering sounded pretty cool. So that was probably one of the my major motivation.
Right.
I kind of knew that I will be an engineer, but then, I thought that's something that...
Well, tell me, what do you understand, or what did you understand, and do you still understand, is the driving force that makes people like to be an engineer as opposed to, let's say, a scientist? Because there's a difference of attitude. Mm-hmm. What's the key feature that you see that attracts yourself and others into being an engineer?
I think, to be honest, my motivation when I was young, a lot of older people told me, you got to be an engineer to make more money.
Well,
I'm trying to be honest.
It's always useful.
I really didn't know the difference between science and engineering.
Right.
Now, after so many years practicing engineering and science, now I belong to the school of engineering and applied science at Yale. So I'm not sure if I'm not even an engineer. I'm not sure I'm an applied scientist. And my feeling these days is that the boundary between the science and engineering is very, faint.
So you took a first degree in career. I think you also had a master's degree.
Yes.
And then you came to North America, as so many of us. Tell us the rationale for that at the time.
Right. So let me step back to my first 2 years in Korea. So that's the time, in 1990, was the time that economy was booming. So if you graduate from top schools in Korea, you are guaranteed to get a nice job. So nobody studied. And also that's the time that, the Korea was politically very unstable. A lot of students spent a lot of time on the street protesting rather than studying. So I had many motivations not to study. I was into many different hobbies. I developed a lot of hobbies. I met a lot of friends and stuff like that. I didn't study at all for the first 2 years. I never got A's, and my GPA was horrible.
You know, that's interesting because you were really, like in a glass house, really nurtured as the student in school. And then you get into the university of your choice and as good as you can get into based upon your grades. And then you just sit back and say, well, I'm successful. And now the future is assured.
Yes, that's what was
it's interesting.
Well accepted in that era because, again, the economy was booming.
Yes.
And the fact that I will be the graduate of SNU means that, you will get the job from the top companies because they are seriously looking for...
You should have stayed with Samsung and developed batteries or something, right?
This would have been...
Okay, right. Anyway, you did come to North America for a PhD.
I'm just trying to tell you the story. Right. So and after 2 years, I did a military service.
Ah.
I came to United States for English training for 6 months. And I chose to go to Colorado Boulder. I should say my parents chose to send me to Colorado Boulder because there are not many Koreans, so I could learn English more. I ended up learning skiing more than English. But anyhow, that's the time that decided to come back to the States because I clearly see the different styles of life, what's provided in America was unmatchable compared to what I was having in Korea. So I decided to come back to the States. But then my GPA was so horrible, so I could not apply for the graduate program in the States. That's the reason why I stayed for master's.
Uh-huh.
So I worked a lot. I worked like a dog, basically, to get some papers out and finally being picked up by the Illinois to do my PhD. So that was the sequence.
Okay. And the PhD was in chemical engineering?
No, PhD was civil and environmental engineering.
Oh, so right.
When I was doing chemical engineering, I started to get more interested in environmental aspect of engineering. And so I did a master's within chemical engineering, but more focused on water treatment. And when I was going for a PhD, I decided to switch the major to become environmental engineer PhD within the civil and environmental engineering.
Okay. And then faculty position at Georgia Tech, and then now your position at Yale. So then you studied and got a PhD. You went to faculty position at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, and now you're at Yale. Tell us what your real passion is about water and water purification and maybe even delivery.
I imagine that in some future, we will have a technology that can be affordable and perhaps does not require power other than sunlight that at least kills the germs in water, because the waterborne pathogen is number one trouble out there, especially when you go to the developing world where there is no proper infrastructure for water treatment.
People who like to predict the future say, well, the next wars or the next conflicts won't necessarily be because of territorial whatever, but driven by the need for water, potable water. I mean, is that a scenario that you understand?
Water is a very complicated issue. It's not only the issue of technology, but it's also technology to treat water, treat the dirty water to the clean water. But also the problem is very complex because of politics, local economy, and the conflict about the resources, and also now the climate change. So there are many different aspects of a problem that requires a contribution from many other people. But my focus is really onto the technology that treat water, turn dirty water into the clean water, and that does not solve the entire problem. I'm just really talking about a very small piece, big puzzle.
The technological aspect of obtaining pure potable water.
Right.
That's where you're at.
Right.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Jae Hong Kim from Yale University Department of Chemical and Environmental Engineering, and we'll be back in one brief moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell with Professor Jae Hong Kim from Yale University's Department of Chemical and Environmental Engineering. We're talking about water. And Professor Kim was just saying that his particular focus is on the technical aspects of water, ignoring, of course, all the complications of politics, geography, global warming, and the like. But before we get onto that, let me just point out that you're here on the border now between Texas and Chihuahua, the United States, and Mexico, separated by a sort of an intermittent river called the Rio Grande. And, of course, that's a shared water resource. And this is one of the big issues. And it's the same in Palestine and Israel. I mean, there are many places around the world where the water source is very simple geographically, but, in fact, it's shared by two or more countries and even further downstream. That is an issue that we won't talk about here, but it's one that the listener should sort of place into the foreground. It's not always simply technical results that can provide help. So having said that, what are your technical issues? What are you trying in your laboratory with your students and your group? What's the direction of water purification that is sort of hot?
Right. I like Star Wars.
Yeah.
I love to think about all the future technologies that is done in far, far away in galaxy. Imagine the Jedi traveling to a planet, and what kind of technology the Jedi will have to treat water when they find the water.
Uh-huh.
And I would only imagine a Jedi mug where you put water, magically it gets cleaned. So something like that.
Right.
Okay. So I'm a dreamer.
So it's got to be simple and portable.
Simple, light enough.
Right.
And it doesn't require
like frequent charging. You don't imagine Jedi spending time charging the bottle, right? So anyhow, so I imagine this bottle. The reason why I talk about the bottle is because solar disinfection, oftentimes called SODIS, is indeed the one of the most frequently used method in a very underdeveloped part of the world to treat water. So basically what you do is you put the water and then leave under the sun and drink it after many hours of sun exposure. So what the sun does is because of this UV radiation and the heat, they disinfect the water. You can imagine that that process is very, very inefficient. How can you change that? Can you imagine a bottle that has some sort of new material that takes the sunlight? And that maybe sunlight is converted into the reactive species that kills the germ. Or maybe the bottle produces UVC, the germicidal radiation. Or maybe there is you can add something and then it just kills the germ and it becomes safe to drink, but something that you added is not like chlorine, which is not good, but is just completely benign to your human body. So that's one of the technologies that we've been dreaming about, and in order for us to reach that, we are spending quite a lot of time developing the basic materials that respond to the sunlight.
So give us a typical material that you've developed.
So one of the material that we recently reported is just like ceramics. So in the fluorescence lamp that we all use, there's this white powder, right? So this white powder, depending on how you do the chemistry, this white powder may accept the visible light that we all have here, and the reason why we can see each other. The visible light is converted to the UVC radiation. UVC is a germicidal lamp, a germicidal light that kills the germ very efficiently. So one of the ideas is to have those powders coated onto sort of bottle or anything such that you place the bottle outside and it kills the germ. So that's the bottom line concept.
But Dev, if I could just interject, usually when you think about molecules fluorescing in this fashion, giving an emission when you irradiate, the energy going out is lower than the energy coming in. Right? We're not getting something for nothing. From what you've just described, the listener may think that we're simply upscaling. The energy is coming in at one level and going out at a much higher energy level.
Right. Keith, I can see that you're a scientist.
Oh, yes. Is that so good or bad?
That's great. I mean, that you're talking about is called down conversion. So one photon comes in, one form of light comes in, higher energy, and then you lose the energy and you produce lower energy. So that's what we do every day.
Right.
Converting UV light to the visible light is what the fluorescence lamp is doing. The process that I just mentioned is called upconversion, in contrast to down conversion. So up conversion means that you actually take two photons and then combine their energy and produce one photon of higher energy. So it's a reverse process of what this fluorescence lamp is doing. I just want to make sure I make this statement. We are that's one of the materials that we've been making. It works, but efficiency is very far from what we really would like to hope to have. So our technology is not there yet.
So it's a two-photon process.
Yes.
So there's two separate excitations.
Yes.
And so that you're taking a low-energy electron, which is what we're talking about, pumping it up to an excited state, and then pumping it to a much higher excited state, so that now when it finally falls down, then you're getting a higher energy than the initial one that you put in.
Sure.
And this is well established in physics and engineering and chemistry nowadays, that that is a principle that is well established. It's how you harness the principle to make a gadget.
Right, that is true. But that upconversion theory has been established for some time, since 1960s. But most of the studies have been done for IR to visible upconversion, mostly for bioimaging. But from the visible to UV, surprisingly not much research, because when I got surprised when I talked to the physicist or chemist about killing germs using UV. It's just like, why? I sometimes even get a question, why? Because we want to treat water. It's a very completely different the mindset. You know, I see fundamental scientists work on many great ideas, but some of them do not necessarily translate into what we really need to achieve. So that's the gap that I'm trying to fill in.
Okay. Now, do you do all of this in a laboratory, or do you actually every now and again venture out into the real world to see can you actually make the results that you're getting in the lab apply in the real world?
So most of the research that we do, we are thinking about probably 10, 20 years ahead. So some of the research that we do, industry-sponsored, have some translation into the real-world practice. But some of the things that I just said, I said I was dreaming. I'm actually dreaming for next 20 years. With that, I actually do go out to the different parts of the world. I have a class at Yale where I take undergraduate students during the spring break for 8 days. So for the half of the semester, we study the existing technologies that can be used to treat water. And then we travel to very remote places in, for example, in Nicaragua. And we spend time implementing those technologies. And we interact with the community people, how to implement those. And then we come back to the campus and spend the rest of the semester analyzing our findings. So I've been doing that for some time.
So this is with standard technologies that are already there. For example, tackling specific problems like, I don't know, excess arsenic in the water and things of that nature, which there are many techniques for doing that. I mean, the simple one is iron oxide. I know this one.
Right.
That you put iron oxide, you run the water over it, the arsenic gets bound, and out comes good drinking water. Is that the type of experiment that you're doing in the field?
Right. So what we do in the field is not even an experiment because this is class. So what they study how the existing methods can be used in the real-world settings. But what we do for research is far in future. So the goal is to close the gap.
Yeah, I understand. But my point was, though, that your students at Yale are actually going into Nicaragua, in this case, and actually showing or demonstrating the utility of a technology that's available now.
Mm-hmm.
How are those students received by the population that you're moving into?
You know, we always work with NGOs. NGOs who are local.
Non-government agencies.
Non-governmental agencies. And those people who have a strong relationship with the local people. Without them, we really even cannot approach to the local community. So through their interface, we spend quite some time educating people what has to be done and, what they can do to better, manage their system. For example, we went to one community last year where they had a small water treatment plant but was not practiced well, and they were having a lot of troubles. So our students went in and spent quite some time to analyze the system and then provided some guidance over. But as you said, if we do that directly to the local community, it doesn't work that well. It has to be transferred through the NGOs who's been working with them such that they have trust from the local people.
So what would be the problem with the water purification plant that was there that was no longer so efficient? Was it a sophisticated plant? Or was it simply a mechanical issue? Or specifically, what were the issues
there are tons
were apparent.
Of issues, but I will just give you one example.
Yes.
There is a chlorine injection at the plant. So chlorine is widely used for disinfection. They had this quite primitive filtration plant. At the end of the filtration plant, they had this very simple funnel type of opening where they shoot at chlorine at a certain rate. And maybe that was transferred 3-4 years ago when the plant was first built, when NGOs were there. But when we visited, what they were doing is adding chlorine once a week as a dump. So what people were getting is non-disinfected, untreated water for the most of the week and one-time chlorine shock.
Right.
Which is not ideal at all.
Neither of those are good options.
Neither are good options, and they didn't know. So what we, when we went out there, we found it, and we kind of worked on how the chlorine should be added. But at the same time, they actually don't know how much they have to add. So what we were doing is to do a very large scale, what is called tracer test, by adding a chemical at the beginning and then measuring the concentration over the entire village over as a function of time.
Was this a radioactive tracer?
No, of course not. We are using simple stuff.
Like what? I mean, we ended up using
chlorine, but another simple chemical that we can use is fluoride or chlorine.
Okay.
Chloride. But anyhow, so we do that kind of full-scale testing, and we also measure the chlorine level at the tap of the house, and then we provide the information how much chlorine should be maintained to provide adequate level of treatment.
Hey, it's been a fascinating program, Jay Hong. We're talking to Jay Hong Kim, professor of chemical and environmental engineering from Yale, all about water. He's got a vision. And may the force be with our guest producer today, Felipe Talavera, and, of course, Norma Martinez, who has always got the force, puts this program together beautifully. And you out there for listening, thank you so much, and we'll be back next week with a totally different Science Studio. Bye-bye.